Okay, so the work that I'll report on today was done in collaboration with a group at the University of Colorado, Julie Lundquist and Clara St. Martin. I'm actually at this company, Enduring Energy. So the principal problem of integration of wind and solar resources into the grid is variability. And, you know, one of the antidotes to variability is geographic diversity. So you can, if the wind is blowing strong in one place, maybe it's not so strong in another place. And so this, you know, the two pictures here are taken from a paper by Willett Kempton, which was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy. So Willett imagines a string of 11 offshore wind farms along the eastern coast of the United States. They use data from meteorological buoys. And so this chart shows the generation duration curves for, you know, each one of these color-coded 11 stations. So those are these curves. And then in black, the curve that you get if you aggregate the power from all 11 stations. So any given station spends a fair amount of its time, like 10 to 20% of its time, at full power, and a fair amount of its time, say again from 20% of its total time, is at zero power. But if you aggregate the power from all of these, right, it spends now a fair amount of time, more time in the middle of the power range of its total capacity, you know, and much, almost zero time is at spent at full power, and almost zero time is spent at zero power. So, you know, this is the effect of geographic diversity. But, you know, we set out to try to understand whether, you know, whether there's some generalities about this. You know, do you have to, you know, run simulations from weather data for every different location in the world, or, you know, can you, you know, are there some conclusions that you can draw in general? So we began by doing Monte Carlo, as George Dyson said, whoops, Monte Carlo is what you do until the mathematician arrives. So we started off with, you know, a PDF that resembled the PDF of one of those typical, you know, Kempton wind farms. That is, you know, it spends a fair amount of time at zero power, spends a fair amount of time at full power, and some relatively smaller amount of time at intermediate power levels. So this is what the PDF of a given, you know, of a typical wind turbine or wind farm looks like. So we drew samples, independent, you know, random samples from this distribution, and then, you know, averaged those samples in pairs, in triplets, you know, in groups of nine, and so on. So, you know, if you look at the distribution of the sum of two samples drawn from this distribution, you know, you, of course, see what you expect, that you convolve this with itself and you get a spike in the middle. Here's the distribution of triplets, the sum of triplets drawn from this. And by the time you get up to n equals 9, you know, this is starting to look like you would expect given the central limit theorem. It's starting to look like a normal distribution. It turns out that it differs from a normal distribution in a very important regard that, you know, I'll return to in a minute. Okay, so here I take the PDFs that I generate, or the histograms that I generated by Monte Carlo on the previous slide, and plot them as generation duration curves. And you can see that my n equals 1 generation duration curve looks like one of these individual plant curves. And it turns out, by more careful examination, that the n equals 4 curve here looks pretty darn close to Kempton's curve for 11 sites. So you might say that the 11 partially correlated wind farms that you know, Kempton simulated from his buoy data look like pretty close to the same as four completely independent sites. But now I promised that I would compare this a little bit more carefully to the normal distribution. So here, you know, we're looking at the tail probabilities. So what are the odds, or what fraction of the time is an aggregated, you know, as an aggregate of wind plants have its output generation below 10% of capacity, and if the average capacity was, you know, 30%, what time is it below 3%? What time is it below 1% of the nameplate capacity? And so this was done by Monte Carlo. As you add, as you consider the averages of larger and larger n-tuples drawn from this n equals 1 distribution, you can see that these tail probabilities decline exponentially. So you're used to perhaps thinking about the standard deviation. The standard deviation declines, or the relative standard deviation declines like 1 over the square root of n. But the tail probabilities don't decline like the square root of n. They decline exponentially. So, you know, these extreme values of the probability, this extreme values of power generation, you know, are their occurrence frequency declines very significantly as the number of independent contributing sites is increased. Okay, so now we'll turn from Monte Carlo data to, you know, some real time series data. We considered three different sets of time series data. One from Canada. This shows we have 117 sites. We looked at 45 years of hourly wind speeds. This shows where the sites that we looked at are located in Canada. We also looked at data from the Bonneville Power Authority. These sites are located along the Columbia River Gorge in the states of Washington and Oregon. And we looked at data from wind plants in Australia. So these are 10 meter height wind speeds. These are taller tower, you know, Met Tower wind speeds. And these data are actual generation data from commercial plants. This data and the BPA data are at 5 minutes, and the Canadian data is hourly. Okay, so as we're looking at correlation falloff versus distance, it's important to note that, you know, there are some features in the data that make it more difficult to understand if you don't, you know, treat them carefully. So this is for the Canadian data. This is the raw, the power spectrum of raw data for one station in Canada. And, you know, it exhibits, you know, a very prominent spectral peak at once per year. That's the seasonal cycle at this station. You know, the wind blows stronger, you know, in the winter than it does in the summer. And there's also, you know, a series of harmonics related to the daily cycle, the diurnal cycle. So if we look at the correlation versus distance for the raw data, that's this dashed brown curve. You can see that, you know, it falls as the sites get further apart, but it doesn't fall to zero. You know, it gets down to about, the correlation coefficient gets down to about 5%, and then it just, you know, stays that way forever. But if we, you know, look at the seasonally varying bias, the wind speed being stronger in one season of the year and slower in another season, if we remove that, which we do by just, you know, filtering out all the low frequencies, then the geographic correlation versus distance now falls to zero. So by removing the very lowest temporal trends in this data, we change the nature of its spatial dependence. Okay, so in the next few slides, I'm going to talk about high-pass filtering, which we do to look in a more general way about at how correlation length depends on time scale. But, you know, I'll give you more explanation for what I'm about to say. But, you know, here we also, even after we removed these, you know, the low frequency and annual trends, if we look at you know, data for which we've removed all trends slower than 33 hours, you know, it still comes down and doesn't, you know, here it's at about 10%. It doesn't go down to zero. So, you know, you have two stations that are far apart, but they're not many time zones apart, you know, so they're both doing this as the sun comes up and goes down. So the correlation versus distance doesn't go to zero. So once we remove these, you know, this diurnal cycle, which we do by, you know, fitting a harmonic, you know, we locally fit a harmonic spectrum to the data and subtract that out. Once we do that, then this, you know, comes down to zero. So in all the subsequent data, times longer than once per 90 days, which is 2,160 hours, have been filtered out. And then, in addition to that, we use another filter and remove, you know, a variable trend slower than some specified thing. And we've also removed, you know, this diurnal cycle. Okay, so this shows, now I'm going to talk about this high-pass filtering. So we wanted to see how plant correlation depends on, you know, this temporal content of the time series. So this is data from one of the stations. You know, as I said before, we've here already removed the diurnal cycle, and we've removed these very long trends. So the data looks like this. So then we just, you know, run a smoothing window over that. This was a 17-hour, you know, rectangular boxcar smoothing. So the data in the blue curve here is the data for a given hourly point here plus the data for, you know, the eight hours on either side of that point, all averaged together. So this blue curve is a smoothed version of this curve on the top. Then we just take this value and subtract it from the corresponding time value of the raw data, and you get this red time series on the bottom, which now has, in this case, all trends slower than once per 17 hours have been subtracted out. Okay, so there are still a few kind of numerical niceties to consider here. So we have 117 stations. That means there's like, you know, 6,000 station pairs. So this shows the correlation scatter plot for, you know, all 6,000 pairs. And, you know, we didn't know what the functional form of this fall off should look like, so we were kind of hesitant to do least squares fitting. So instead of least squares fitting, we just, you know, numerically integrate this rho of r versus r data, and we get a curve that looks like this. And, you know, the terminal point of this curve, you know, represents the area under all of this data. So we just call that the integral scale. So here's the data for Canada, the correlation for data for Canada presented in a kind of familiar form. This is the number on each, the label on each curve represents the high pass filter time constant. So all trends slower than 65, 129, 2000 hours have been removed. The correlation falls with distance. It falls faster the shorter the filter time constant. So, you know, this would tell you that if, with regard to grid integration, you know, small, fast fluctuations can be effectively smoothed by aggregating power from a smaller area. Okay, now this is our integral scale metric, which just is a way to obtain that same kind of information without doing any fitting. You see that in Canada, for example, for the longest temporal trends, this integral scale metric is about 280 kilometers, and it drops rapidly with filter time constant. This is the data in Australia. The wind farms in Australia are not spread out as far as the 5,000 kilometer distance that we had in Canada, so these curves don't get quite to saturation. Here in the BPA, you know, notice that these scales are different, 250, 350, 80, you know, in the BPA, for reasons that I, for one, don't really want to speculate about, the correlation lengths are smaller. So this is my final plot here. So here we compare the correlation versus correlation, normalized correlation length versus time filter time scale for the three regions. So I took the ultimate value, the value for the slowest, with the slowest trends allowed in, and divided all the other data by that. So like in Canada, I took the correlation length versus filter time scale and divided them all by 280 kilometers. So what you see is that for filter time constants, you know, longer than like a day or 2 days, there's no effect of high-pass filtering on the correlation length. But once you get below a day or so, you know, the correlation length falls rapidly with time constant. So, for example, at 10 hours, the correlation length is about 1/10 of what it is, you know, for the unfiltered data. So that says at 10 hours, you could get, you know, geographic diversity in 1% of the area that you would need to get the same degree of smoothing for like 1-3 day trends. So that concludes my talk. Thanks.
So we have all the time for two questions. Thank you, Mark.
I'm David Pozo from the University of Jaén, south of Spain. Really interesting your work, but I was wondering, what is the role of the geographic diversity? Because the correlation of the wind depends on the weather pattern, but also on the geographic diversity, topography, etc. So the study areas are mainly flat areas. It's they have some kind of topographic features. And the other question is, have you tried to evaluate the spatial correlation based on principal component analysis, for instance?
Okay, so I can give a very simple answer to the second question, which is no. We haven't looked at principal component analysis. Now, as to the first question, I'm not sure I understood that. You know, we averaged over continental scale topography in the case of Canada, right? So some correlations are higher and some correlations are lower. And, you know, I suppose you could say, for example, that the BPA data shows a shorter correlation length because, you know, it's more there's more topography there. But, you know, I'm not sure that that's systematic. I mean, there's a lot of noise in this data, and, you know, I don't know what it means. I'm not sure if that answers your question, but.
To piggyback off that gentleman's question, I think you mentioned that most of the wind data you measured at 10 meters.
The Canadian data is at 10 meters. The Australian data is hub height. It's wind generation data.
Right. Okay, so at 80-meter hub height then. So since you're using different heights, I guess, to, you know, Canadian level 10 meters and the other sites at 80 meters, wouldn't you want to perhaps have data for all three locations coming at from the same height, say, for instance, you know, do you think it would make a difference whether you're measuring at 10 versus 80?
So ask me if I want more data, right? That one's easy, yes. But, you know, so the Canadian correlation length is 280 kilometers, and in Australia it was like 350, right? So I wouldn't call that a very big difference. So to go from 10-meter measurement height to wind turbines, you know, didn't seem to make a big difference.